I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 5, Second Movement, Clarion Call, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, that's me, with Janice Collier. Thursday, March 4th, 2410. Green Sector Central Habitat, The Garden. International Police Station Babylon 6. Bahava L System, Centaurus Sector. Skuld Ravenhair never got tired of the garden. By her lights, it was the cleverest thing about Babylon 6's design. She'd always had a bit of a fondness for space habitats that tried to be more than just a hull to keep the air in, and the sensation of standing in B6's hollow center and looking up at the inside-out world of the habitat ring was one of the finer examples of the genre. B6 wasn't the biggest space station around, it wasn't the most luxurious, and it for damn sure wasn't the most technologically advanced. It didn't even have artificial gravity in the normal operating regime. But it did have this one peerless place. A fitting spot for her only son to get married in. Finding a venue for the occasion hadn't been easy. Most of the places she and her sisters had thought of first turned out to be too small, given the truly spectacular number of people who had, as a matter of course, to be invited. Those on the original list that were large enough were, by and large, lacking the right atmosphere for such an occasion. For example, the Avalon County Coliseum would have probably have done space-wise, but there was no way Skuld was going to agree to that. And while both she and Corwin might have been all right with the second choice on the list, the new Avalon Battledrome, Beldandy had vetoed that one. At their wits' end, the sisters had turned the matter over to the father of the groom, who hadn't managed to think of anything better. In the end, it was someone entirely unconnected to the occasion who made the winning suggestion. Back, Wednesday, March 3rd, 2410. And we still don't have a decent place to have the thing. We thought the castle was going to be plenty big enough until we actually bothered to do the math. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. I mean, if it were summer, we could do it outdoors in New Avalon, say in Avalon Center Park or Veterans Park, or on Gerardo out next to the castle. But it's freaking March, and of course we had to put DSM in a climate band that more or less matched with New Avalon. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. So that's no good. Everybody'd freeze to death. Griffin threw up his hands. Site prep needs to start no later than tomorrow morning. This is a complete disaster. Corwin's going to kill me if Utrina doesn't get to me first. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. Oh, hey, leave it to me, I said. Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. I figured, what the hell, I'm Mr. Big Time Organizer, right? I put the Wedge Defense Force back together, I organized the IPO, I kicked off New Avalon, for Christ's sake. How hard could it be? Griff, said Derek Bacon mildly. But can I do a simple thing like find a place for my son's wedding? No, that's apparently a task quite beyond my... Derek put a hand on Griffin's shoulder and said in a tone only fractionally less mild, Griff. Griffin skidded to a verbal halt and sighed. Yes, Derek. Derek pointed out the window of the Babylon 6 core shuttle they were both riding. Have it there, he said. Return. Now Skuld and her sisters were on the scene, supervising the station's public affairs staff, as they prepped a grassy area in the middle of the habitat ring to serve as the venue for an outdoor ceremony. Truth to tell, there wasn't really a lot of supervising to be done. This was far from being the station staff's first rodeo, as it were. They knew how to handle the basic broad strokes stuff. All they needed from the Norns was help with the specifics. Bell had the catering well in hand, of course, and, though the very thought still filled some part of Skuld's soul with fear, Ord was looking after the entertainment. For once, Caitlin would be able to participate in the occasion without having to wrangle the musicians as well. Fortunately, Erd wasn't seeing to that personally, but she was overseeing the arrangements all the same, which left Skuld with a task important not so much to the ceremony itself as to its traditional preparations. The meadow where the ceremony was to be conducted was physically already prepared, The chairs were arranged, the dais, the canopy, all of it ready to go. Skuld's job was to see to the construction, a short distance away, of two proper Asgardian bathhouses. Unlike the setup for the wedding, this was something the staff of Babylon 6 had no previous experience with, though they were proving to be highly adaptable and competent as Skuld directed them through the process. They'd have the houses up and functional in plenty of time, though she didn't even want to ask where they'd found the wood, either for it or for the feast hall Erd was seeing to at the other end of the meadow. All in all, and despite the fantastically short notice, there was no indication that the thing would come off in any way other than well. Many of the really important preparations weren't dependent on the venue, and had been taken care of weeks before, and the last-minute uncertainty over the location wouldn't be a problem for anyone on the guest list with the kind of transportation network this particular couple could call upon. They'd all known they'd be going somewhere on Friday the 5th. It was up to the guides to make sure they got wherever it was. No problem. Yeah. It looked like this was going to go according to plan after all. International Police Visiting Officers' Quarters, Blue Sector, Babylon 6. Having been told in no uncertain terms to take himself out of the way while more competent persons handled the rest of the logistics, Benjamin Hutchins had little to do with himself, so he spent the morning in his seldom-used office on Babylon 6, mostly chopping through the expediting paperwork for his latest unofficial project. With that done, he resisted the urge to go snoop around the garden and instead took himself down to the VOQ, a block of staterooms set aside for the use of, as the name implied, IPO officers without a permanent billet aboard the station. As he stepped off the lift into the corridor segment set aside as the VOQ, he paused for a moment to return the salute of the uniformed TACDIV officer on duty. Must be a new guy, he thought, then headed down toward the second room from the end. As he approached, Griffin thought he could hear faint music seeping into the hall. That was slightly odd, given how heavily insulated all the quarters were aboard the station, but he didn't think too much about it. If anything, it gave him a mild feeling of nostalgia. It felt like walking down a dormitory hallway of an early evening in those near-forgotten mythic days before the universe took a sudden right turn, feeling the bass of somebody's favorite study music rumbling through the floor but able to make out little else about the tune. He stopped at the room he wanted, keyed the annunciator, and waited. Nothing happened. He keyed it again. Still nothing. Well, he thought wryly, I am the chief. He punched an override code into the keypad. The door opened, and a wall of sound nearly bowled him over as it poured out into the corridor from the room beyond. Griffin staggered briefly, more out of surprise than anything else, then regrouped and stepped inside, and damn near burst out laughing. There was really no other response a reasonable man could make to the sight of two robots, one sleek and ultra-modern, the other blocky and utilitarian, dancing together to the sounds of 20th-century rock music blasting at an imprudent, but, Griffin noted with approval, crystal clear, volume from the chest panel of one of them. Griffin tried to keep quiet. Why intrude on such a carefree moment if he didn't have to? But the deck was stacked against him, and when the little tracked robot managed, despite his awkward construction and the fact that his dance partner had no legs at all, to pull off a nice approximation of a spin and dip, he couldn't stop himself from laughing any longer. A lot of men would have been, at the very least, annoyed to find themselves in this situation. The more sophisticated robot was, soon, he was fairly sure, to be had been, his property, the brand new product of a concerted research and development effort spanning nearly 10 years, and costing a number of credits he hadn't even bothered to have anyone count for fear of finding it depressing. Had been, until he'd sent her off on her shakedown mission and she'd returned, not only with the object of her search, but also with a beat-up antique Wall Series trash compactor droid and the unmistakable signs of true sapience. Griffin wasn't a lot of men, and anyway, he happened to think robots developing true sapience was pretty damn cool. It didn't appear as though Eve had really gotten accustomed to the idea yet, though. At his laugh, she turned her head, blinked, and then reached out with a lightning-quick hand to punch the stop key on Wally's playback controls. The music stopped instantly, and Eve snapped to something as close to attention as a levitating robot whose arms and head were not, strictly speaking, actually attached to her body, could manage, her uncannily expressive blue LED matrix eyes wide with surprise. Wally, facing away from the door and thus unaware of precisely how the situation had changed, kept dancing for a couple of seconds before Eve gave him a sharp poke akin to an elbow in the ribs and hissed his name in an exasperated tone out of the side of her hidden vocoder. Puzzled, Wally slid to a halt and gave his companion a confused look. Eve tilted her head toward the door and muttered tersely, "Chief." "Huh? Oh!" Wally about-faced smartly and at last took notice of their visitor. Instead of reacting with startled embarrassment, though, he waved cheerfully and made a carefully modulated electronic noise that was almost, but not quite, "Hi-o!" Griffin collected himself, but didn't stop, couldn't stop, grinning as he stepped into the room and let the door shut behind him. "Good choice of tune," he observed. "Hot-blooded. Foreigner, 1978. At ease, Eve, you're off duty," he added with a wink. "Anyway, I have good news. I just got off the phone with the Turing Institute. They're sending a field evaluator to have a look at you this afternoon. She'll run a few simple tests, and I expect that'll be that. You guys won't belong to anyone." Eve blinked, her eye expression changing from embarrassed surprise to simple astonishment. Griffin figured he knew more or less how she felt. She'd been online for just over a month. She'd completed only a single mission, and already she was on the verge of becoming a free intelligence? A lot of robots spent their entire operational careers and never developed that strange, ineffable spark, and here were two of them, two who had found each other to boot. What were the odds? As Griffin thought it, he realized that Eve could probably calculate them. "Anyway, it's nothing to worry about. Having seen you two in action, I can't see how it's anything other than a formality, but I wanted to warn you ahead of time so you had a chance to get ready. You know, psyched up." He grinned and had a better look at them. "You look good," he told Eve. "Those scuff marks buffed right out." She bobbed slightly in the air, looking a trifle bashful. Griffin turned his attention to Wally. "How about you? Feeling good?" Wally nodded vigorously. Truth be told, he found it all a little overwhelming. All his life he'd known only the grunge and toil of the scrapyard, with only the endless vistas of refuse to look at and only Hal, his pet cockroach, for company. To be suddenly swept up and transported to this place of clean, precise lines, shiny new machinery, and friendly people, well, he wouldn't have traded it for certain, but all the same it was going to take some getting used to. All this was quite beyond his ability to articulate, doubly so since he wasn't fitted with a vocoder, and so could only roughly approximate speech using his industrial signaler, but that didn't bother him either. He was quite capable of doing all the communicating he needed to do. "Well, I won't keep you," Griffin said. "I'll be back when I escort the Turing evaluator down, probably in a couple of hours. In the meantime," he gestured, smiling, to Wally, "carry on." Wally perked up and reached for his play button, but before he could press it, Eve held out a hand in a just-a-second gesture, and then darted to intercept Griffin before he could leave. "Chief," she said, looking a bit worried. "Yes?" he asked. Eve paused as if considering how to put what she had to say. Though she was equipped with a proper vocabulator, she didn't talk much. Griffin wasn't sure whether she hadn't developed a full free speech facility yet or was simply taciturn by nature. Finally, trusting him to understand what she was getting at, she looked searchingly at him and said, "Directive?" Griffin blinked. "Directive," he mused. Then, brightening, he said, "Oh, I get it. Don't worry, we'll talk about that after the evaluator's made her decision." With a twinkle in his eye, he added, "I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about a job offer." Eve looked relieved, and more than a little pleased, as she moved out of his way. Griffin smiled to himself as he walked up the corridor, hands in pockets, and heard the music start up again before the door whined shut in his wake. "Is my timing right? Did you save your love for me tonight?" The The security officer saluted again as he drew near. Griffin paused, returned the salute again, and decided to let the kid in on the game. "It's okay if you don't salute me," he said, smiling. "We're not in the army." The young officer blinked. "Yes, sir." "May I ask a question, sir?" Griffin hit the button to summon the lift, read the man's top pocket name tape, and said, "Fire away, TAC Officer Cassidy." "My watch commander told me this was a temporary posting. Why special security on this level today?" "Just a precaution," Griffin said. "I have a couple of friends in the VOQ today, and I don't want them bothered." "The two robots?" "That's right." With a look that was more questioning than challenging, Griffin asked, "Got a problem with a man having robots for friends, Cassidy?" The crew-cut young man went slightly pink. "Oh, no, sir," he said quickly. "Absolutely not, sir. I'm from Regal." "Ah," said Griffin. "We're seeing more and more of you guys joining up since Sergeant Barlow started making the news. What section are you from?"
"Purplenum, sir."
Griffin nodded. "Well, carry on, Officer Cassidy. Nobody enters this floor without my authorization, at least until after our guest from Turing 3 makes her appearance." He smirked slightly. "After that, any half-wit bot basher who gets it into his head to tangle with Eve is on his own." Cassidy chuckled. "Amen to that, sir. Those guys don't last long back home. Usually just long enough to run into their first RA cast." At the prescribed distance from the station, a black wing-shaped spacecraft thundered out of hyperspace in a flash of light, then coasted quickly to a near halt before its sublight thrusters spooled up to power. In the cockpit, an unshaven, slightly scuffed young man smiled a tired smile, guided the vessel into the approach traffic pattern, and dialed his comm system. "Babylon Control," he said, "this is Hotel Delta Kilo 8212, private starship One-Hit Wonder, requesting permission to approach for docking."
"Roger, One-Hit Wonder, I have you on my scope," replied the voice of Babylon Control. "Your vector looks good. You're cleared for approach." "Is that you, Lieutenant Corwin?"
Corwin Ravenhair grinned. "It is indeed, Lieutenant Corwin." He wasn't a lieutenant, strictly speaking, but what was the point of having a private joke if you weren't willing to bend the facts a little to accommodate it? "Your parents are causing quite a stir down in Green Sector today," Lieutenant David Bruce Corwin informed him with audible amusement.
"So I've heard," Corwin replied wryly. As if to underline the point, the Wonder slid past the sleek, silvery-white bulk of IPS Challenger, the International Police Space Force flagship, and until very recently his father's own command, parked and keeping station a few miles from Babylon 6. Not far away was the sleek, imposing bulk of a Seleucian Arcadia-class battleship in the colors of the Imperial Guards.
"I'm forbidden to go see what they're up to until tomorrow," Corbin added.
"Ah, well, good luck."
"Thanks. I'm in the lane now. Request docking clearance."
"Roger, One-Hit Wonder. Docking clearance granted. Stand by for ADC handover."
A moment later, a light appeared on his helm console, indicating that the station's automatic docking control system was requesting handover. Corwin flipped the appropriate toggle switch from off to auto. In a small window below the switch, a mechanical indicator switched from displaying a blank gray flag to one with alternating gray and white slanted stripes.
"Thank you, Babylon Control," he said. "ADC is Barberpold. You have control. One-Hit Wonder out."
Guided by the tractor beams and remote helm inputs of the ADC, the Wonder flew serenely into the yawning opening on the front of Babylon 6, then was shunted off from the central core through an atmospheric retention field and to a gentle landing in one of the smaller hangar bays, one she shared, Corwin noticed, with his father's slightly newer Corellian, Dagger Disc. Disembarking from the ship, he locked up, shouldered his duffel bag, and walked across the hangar past Dagger Disc to the exit. When he emerged into the interior hallway, he turned right without thinking about it, intending to head for the quarters in Green Sector, outboard, nowhere near the garden, where the Valiant's crew always stayed when they stopped aboard B-6. Just before he reached the lift, though, he noticed a figure blocking his path and stopped.
"Wrong way, champ," said his mother with a smile. "You're in the VOQ tonight."
Corwin sighed, his shoulders sagging.
This is ridiculous. He grumbled as he let Scold turn him around and start guiding him back the other way.
This is what you asked for. A traditional Asgardian ceremony with all the trimmings, and this is what you get. You're lucky your grandmother's even letting you have it in Midgard. She would certainly not stand for you seeing your bride the day before the wedding.
Corwin rolled his eyes and replied, Just for the record, I asked for no such thing.
Yeah, well, when your grandparents are the Allfather and his wife, sometimes you just have to humor them, Scold pointed out. Anyway, how'd it go? Did you get it?
Corwin shook the duffel bag on his shoulder a little bit, eliciting a muffled metallic rattle.
Yes, and remind me never, ever to do anything like this again.
I can't believe I raised a son with such a stunted sense of adventure, Scold jokingly complained.
Knowing he wouldn't win anyway, he let her guide him to the visiting officer's quarters, past the security officer, why a security officer here, and to the stateroom all the way at the end.
Stay on this deck, Scold told him. Don't roam around. We don't want to take any chances.
Corwin sighed. Yes, ma'am, he said heavily.
Scold smirked slightly, kissed him on the cheek, and said, Just one more day. Your attendants will be here at 10:30.
Corwin acknowledged the implicit instruction to be ready, endured a few moments of sentimentality from his misty-eyed mother, and saw her off. Then shut the door and wondered what the hell to do with himself for the next, glance at watch, 20 hours. Well, there was always sleeping. Gods knew he hadn't done a lot of that in the last 48. With that in mind, Corwin flopped onto his bunk, sighed, and lay there for a few minutes with his forearm across his forehead, regarding the ceiling expressionlessly. Then, as a thought struck him, he moved his arm away from his head and regarded his wristwatch for a moment.
Hell, I'm not going to see her, he thought, and reached out with his consciousness.
The contact took only a moment to establish, and when it was made, he felt a combination of surprise and faint, conspiratorial amusement filter back to him.
Hey, he said.
Hey yourself, Utina replied. Isn't this bad luck?
Pah,
errant superstition. How you holding up?
Fine, fine,
she said, and Corwin snickered a little bit because she sounded just like his father when she said that.
You?
Tired but intact. I'm confined to the VOQ up in blue for the evening. How's your outfit coming along?
Belle's outdone herself.
I think you'll like it.
Of course I will. Mind you, I'd be just as happy if you showed up in blue jeans and one of my old Pendleton shirts.
Getting kicks the guests will never understand, Utina observed, her smirk carrying across the lens link.
Would they dare to suck a sleeve? Corwin asked rhetorically.
Anyway, I just wanted to check in, let you know I made it back.
And buck the system a little.
And buck the system a little, he agreed. Guess I'll see you tomorrow, then, he added, unconvincingly nonchalant.
Yeah, if I don't think of something better to do in the meantime, Utina replied.
Have a good night, Corwin.
You too, he said. And then the link was gone.
He looked at his watch again and gave himself a wry smile.
Good night, it wasn't even 3 p.m. yet. If he went to sleep now, he'd be waking up sometime in the evening, his schedule completely disrupted, unable to go back to sleep at all, and with a grueling day of rather complicated, almost entirely unrehearsed theatricality to get through. No, that wouldn't do at all. He'd have to stay awake until at least 2100. 2200 would be better, and with that, he fell asleep.